Hey guys, new episode here with Dwight McCormick. Just wanted to take a quick second to say hello and thank you, especially to our Jackson listeners. I was fortunate enough to go to Jackson this weekend and perform with my best good friend Jay Snyder and a benefit show for one of his relatives, and had a great time just hanging out. The show was fun. It was not typical, fully lit room, kids. But we made the best of it, and I have to say, one of the best shows I've had in a while. Hard to call it a show. It was more of a hang. We hung out, we had a good time. So thank you to those people. Some of you I met for the first time. You know who you are, and it was nice to be able to put a face to a name. And I don't want to out anybody, but thank you for all of the things that you do for our podcast. Namely, listening, those of you that listen. So, thank you. Share, follow, comment, whatever it is that you do. Today's episode with Dwight McCormick. We sat outside in Yellow Springs last weekend, and it was a beautiful day. You might hear a little bit of wind noise, but it's few and far between. You might hear some background noises, but we put the headset on and sat right outside between the Emporium and Dino's Coffee. And shot the shit. It starts off a little congenial, us catching up, and then we move into some rather controversial topics. If you've ever wondered why or how a comedian does comedy and is also working another job, it depends on what the job is. But when the job is being a pastor, even that is a little bit amazing to me sometimes, but I think you're tickling the same nerve when it comes to speaking to the masses. Dwight is a fascinating character and human being, and just to be honest, if more pastors were like him, religion would be more popular. And like more popular, it's the most popular thing around. Religion in and of itself, very popular. Can you tell I'm rambling already? That's how long it's been. It's been too long. Last Monday was the last cast with Jay Snyder. This week we're doing Dwight McCormick, and we're going to keep it moving. I've got some very special guests lined up, and I hope you guys are enjoying. Let me know if there's anything I could do differently that you would enjoy. Still enjoy bringing you the cast for free. No ads, no request for money. No request for ransom. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Enjoy the cast, guys. Thank you to Jackson, Ohio. Thank you to Yellow Springs, Ohio. Thank you to all of our listeners. Please follow us on the Podbean app or Stitcher or iTunes, wherever you listen, and download every episode automatically so that they were there waiting for you, and you're sitting in the airport waiting. Did I finish talking about all that stuff? I think I did talk about all that stuff. Anyway, yeah. Love you guys. Enjoy the cast. Stay unrelated.
You're tuned into Totally Unrelated with Jay Snyder and Adrian Cosby. Enjoy.
And we're back. I am in the belly of the beast, Yellow Springs, my hometown, my stomping grounds of my youth and my adulthood. And
what's up?
I'm sitting with Dwight McCormick,
Yeah.
the pastor, the preacher, the comedian. And this is awesome with the headsets because I can sit back.
Right.
I don't even have to yell across.
Right.
Welcome to Yellow Springs, brother.
Hi. Glad to be here. It was kind of an interesting. Just saw Dave Chappelle walk by
yeah,
and greet us. That was kind of neat.
That's who I was talking to for the last hour, waiting for you.
Oh, nice.
What have you been up to, man? It seems like it's been a while since I've sat down.
Yeah, been a long time. More than a year that we sat down and talked and had a conversation, I think. Well, just mainly working at work and being a dad and a husband.
Yeah.
A lot of work on the homestead, try to build up relationships and kind of get foundations repaired and rebuilt and try to make sure things are shored up so that when I go back and do some more comedy that I'm not as self-centered maybe and trying to do you know, you can't help but be self-centered to be on stage and be a comic. That's part of it. But
it's
dysfunction at some point, though, you know.
Yeah, well, it's one of the benefits and one of the curses of wanting to talk to a lot of people is right. The idea that you've got something that they want to hear.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, from a pastor's perspective to right. a comedian's perspective mm-hmm. to a motivational speaker, I don't right. know what gives anybody the right.
Right.
But if people listen, mm-hmm. then I guess that's the calling.
Right.
So have you been taking a break from comedy?
Not an intentional one. I've done probably about once every 2 or 3 months. I do basically where I'm getting booked is in church shows, fundraisers, and obviously I have a clean comedy and Christian comedy bent, and
right.
A lot of black folks are hiring me for where I'm mainly the white guy, the token guy on,
yeah,
the,
yeah, yeah,
on
yeah.
the gig, and that crowd, a lot of times black folks are church folks, and so being a preacher and being booked on a church show, it's a perfect demographic, and it's fun to be a part of those shows. There are a lot of high energy, a lot of silliness, and so it kind of feels like you're coming home, you know, when you go and do those gigs.
It is, and it's interesting because it's like I worked with Donnie Baker and Keith Irvin a couple of weeks ago, and
right.
it's sort of an odd couple pairing to
sure.
have Keith Irvin open up for Donnie Baker, but it works right. because right. of the odd couple pairing, and
right.
I think the if anybody was going to get traction
uh-huh.
in what we would describe as an urban audience,
mm-hmm.
A pastor mm-hmm. with the intensity that you bring to
right.
stand up, it's very... I don't even know how to describe it, but it's one of those things where it's like, I can see black people within like the first 30 seconds, like, I like this guy.
Often you know? That's the case. Well, I got, you know, black comic friends have kind of helped give me some lines that are great openers, and
sure.
That doesn't hurt. And then have a pretty sincere heart for social justice and racial justice and equality. And I think I don't feel super afraid around black folks in general. So
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think sometimes that translates. I don't know if it always does. I was doing a show down. It was a open mic at this cupcake place in Dayton, Ohio, and Nate Washington was on that, and Mark Gregory. He's a guy that gets me a lot of work and is real good to me. And I was the only white person in the room, and Nate was like said something along the lines of like, Dwight looks like a white grain of rice in a big bowl full of black beans, and he doesn't look uncomfortable at all. I don't know why.
You're just soaking it up.
Just trying to be a good guest. I know it's not my space, you know, try not to act entitled or like I deserve whatever I'm getting. I'm just grateful to be able to be a part of it. And that's used to be more like lip service, but now it's true from the heart gratitude. I'm kind of grateful to be alive.
I'd say that the thing that I noticed in when you have a predominantly or exclusively black audience is that they, I don't want to say have a tendency, but they just see through fakeness
true.
In a way that,
right.
that maybe other audiences, I'm not going to say that an all white audience doesn't see the fakeness
right,
too.
Right,
it's just that
true.
They might be more willing to let you go with it.
Mm-hmm, right,
like, oh, this
right.
is how he sees himself or something.
Sure,
whereas black
right.
people are like, I ain't buying it.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
And, I had that experience, last summer when I was really kind of hitting the road hard, and I was doing the Cleveland Improv where I had never had a
mm-hmm.
good set, and
mm-hmm.
I was really in my own head about it and a lot of fear,
mm-hmm.
and that translated. And when I finally just let go of that fear, I was like, you know
right.
what? These jokes worked in other
right.
cities all over the country.
Right.
They're
going
to work here. I just have to
mm-hmm.
own it.
Right.
And once I owned it, it was
yeah.
it transformed the weekend for
yeah.
me. So I
yeah.
think that there's definitely, you know, as any performer, you know, the main battle's in your head.
Right.
You know,
that's for
the
sure.
number one enemy.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I'm horrible in my brain, self-defeating a lot, and it's anybody that struggled with self-confidence or had any kind of issues growing up, that's a big thing. You know, if we aren't confident on stage, though, then we're no reason to go on stage if
yeah.
you don't have any confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
You've already lost before you get up there.
That's
you
know? That's the thing.
I kind of like to think, too, that there's a spiritual element to it, especially being Christian, that if I'm in a Christian crowd, and black or white, that if the folks that there are there to have a good time and what I'm offering is in a spirit of fun and joy and I'm legitimately having fun, the crowd 99.9% of the time has joy and fun. But I believe that's God.
Yeah.
Like the spirit of God at work, a flow, something. But it's the same energy in any crowd. You don't have to name it God. That's just my higher power. That's what I name it. But any crowd, I think, has an energy.
Yes.
And then when we can key into whatever energy that is and play, man, there's nothing like it. It's like a big tidal wave, you know, it feels good. You can either ride it, get crushed by it, you know.
That's a really interesting concept, and I think a lot of guys would be like, ah, it's a bunch of horse manure.
It may be,
but
that's my experience of it.
I think I totally agree, yeah. And I think the fact that you even are willing to accept that maybe it's something else, but I think it, in your case, it probably is God or some universal thread
right.
through God
right.
that is being translated, because what it is you're kind of giving them a context that they can say, all right, mm-hmm. I'm familiar with this. So what I try to do to get the energy moving in my direction mm-hmm. is to have them be able to look at me and think, I know this guy mm-hmm. before I even say a word.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
not necessarily like I know who he is and what he stands for,
right.
but just like, because some guys come up and it's like, it's just off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not dressed well.
Mm-hmm.
They're not speaking well.
Mm-hmm.
They're not standing up straight. It's just one of those things where it's like, mine is like, he looks like he's here because he's supposed to be here.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you
always
I mean?
Look sharp. You always, I think you're pretty intentional about what you wear, right?
Intentionality is the number one thing.
I usually wear a suit, and it's because if I don't, often people are like, is he really a preacher? Is that just a shtick? And I'm just like, yeah, that's probably the best shtick I could ever think of. No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if I'm wearing a suit, I think it helps convey the truth of it. And then my material, obviously, is geared in that.
You in a suit. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that. Reminds me of Steve Martin.
Well, I wasn't going to compare myself to him.
Well, I mean,
but, right,
you're much funnier than he is, obviously. So.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. The bank account shows.
Talking about BS. but I he was in a New York Times article talking about his master's writing class.
Yeah.
And he said something about, I can't remember the name of the performer. It was a street magician, and he said, always look better than they do.
Yeah.
Which sounds a little, you know, I don't know what you call it, maybe elitist. And there's also some truth to, if you look like you're there to put on a show, that helps.
Yeah.
It helps.
Yeah.
It really is. And it's saying I respect the audience, too. You know,
mm-hmm.
like, this is, I'm doing some work. I want to do a good job. I want to look nice. And part of that is wearing something that looks like I'm supposed to be here, like you were saying.
Yeah. Well, I think some people hate suits, and some people
sure. yeah,
would
yeah.
never wear a suit.
Right. And that's not for everybody. Yeah.
yeah but at the end of the day, it's like when people paid money to see a performer,
mm-hmm.
you kind of want to look the part.
Well, what's the guy, Rob, out of Columbus that had the Don't Wear Shorts on Stage or Never Wear Shorts on Stage book? Is his name
Rob? I know who he is. I met him one time.
He looks
time.
A little bit like Jeff Goldblum. And,
he's a
good dude. But, yeah, that's his premise, is you try to, you know, try to look like you care.
Yeah, yeah.
if you look like you don't care, then neither does the audience. They're like, okay, he doesn't? Well, I don't either. I'm going to keep drinking, and whoever comes up next, I'll listen. You
know? Yeah, I think that there's a I don't know what it is that has comics – we're like our own police, you know, and
right.
there's books and there's
true, yeah.
blogs and there's all these different.
Right. There's no one way. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
am I?
Yeah.
I have very little experience and very, you know, I'm not an authority.
I would say.
This is from my experience, I should start every statement.
Sure. And I would say this. I would uh-huh. personally, although I have worn shorts on stage, but it was like at an extremely hot open mic.
Right. Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Outdoor gig. Anything, any always or covers or gets
yeah,
us in trouble, right?
Yeah. And I think also one of those, it's the type of thing to just be aware
mm-hmm.
that starting at a deficit isn't going to help you.
Oh, true.
You know
true,
what I mean?
Right. Yeah,
and
yeah,
I
yeah.
think a lot of people are like, no, I got into comedy because I want to do everything my way.
Right, right.
I don't do punchlines. And, you know, it's like at the
I'm
end of the day.
I'm doing this thing where I don't speak on stage. It's really, you know, well, I guess that worked for what's his face? Tape Mouth or whatever his name is. Tape Face? Did you ever see that dude?
No.
He like almost won America's Got Talent.
Oh,
like,
my God.
And
taping his face up?
He had a tape over his mouth the whole time. I can't remember what it is. I think it's called Tape Face. And he like made it to the semifinals. I was like, okay.
All right. Well, you know.
Well, for everybody, proves there's a market for everybody. Which
that's true.
For me, I'm grateful because that's a
yeah.
I'm a niche market like
yeah.
that. You know, is it niche?
Niche. Depends on how elitist you are.
N-I-C-H-E.
I like to say quiche market.
Quiche market, yeah.
That's an egg dish.
Right.
I know for me starting out, I didn't put a lot of thought into like what the audience wanted to hear, or maybe I thought too much about like what I thought the audience wanted to hear.
True.
But, lately the journey for me has been more like what you're saying, is to kind of create the energy and then ride the wave
right.
through it. But these shows like I did this week in this casino,
mm-hmm. Man, the energy scattered there. I would imagine.
There's just an infinite number of distractions in some in some of them, and some of them are unexpectedly good, and some of them you think are going to be great are unexpectedly bad, and you never really know, because a casino crowd is never. It's like not replicatable. You know what I mean? Like you're never going to see this same crowd in another casino, and. I don't know what it is about those types of shows, but I remember, flying back, I remember thinking to myself from this last weekend, like, I don't want those types of experiences to be the norm.
Right.
You know, and so it's like I started writing based on this fact of, like, I need better jokes for the casino. Uh-huh. Because this one guy came up to me after, he said, man, you are in Auburn, Washington.
Yeah.
If we were anywhere else, man, that was hilarious. And he's like, I'm from New York. So I'm telling you, that was hilarious. But this, I saw people looking at each other, looking up words you was using. I was like, he said, are you a comedian, man?
That's always a great, great thing when somebody afterwards, it's a stranger, is trying to console you.
Yeah. It's the best because it's like in poker. In poker, sometimes you'll see somebody who wins a hand they weren't supposed to win the river.
Right.
And then they start going, oh, man, you know, I thought I had the best hand. And it's like they're trying to console the person that just lost a crap ton of money.
Right,
it's like nothing you can say
makes
it feel any
there
better.
There isn't anything you're going to do really get, making out, get me out of my head. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like it's not about – I'm trying to win the war, not the battle.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And the battle for me now is doing this new material that I'm doing, which is a lot cleaner and a lot more storyline based, a lot less race material is what I'm focusing on this year. And it keeps coming back.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I keep having this recurring, like, oh, this would be a great. I'm like, no, that's not what we're working on right now. So I'm just trying to train my brain to get into the next level of performance.
That's a challenge.
Yeah, because I don't even really know what that is.
I don't know what it is for me either.
I know I'll know it when I start doing it, but I've been working less currently. Well, not even less currently, but like last year was like a whirlwind from May till December.
Mm-hmm.
And then since December, it's been much more normal, you know, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off or so.
Right.
And the 2 weeks off has been killing me. It's been killing my motivation and everything, and so I'm having to come up with new tricks to keep myself interested.
Yeah, I listened to the most recent episode, just finished listening to it not long before I got here, and it sounded like you were in a funk. So
Yeah, a little bit, and I think also...
I'll just tell you, if you were in New York, man, you wouldn't be in a funk. You'd be... you would always
man,
be
they
hilarious.
Would be, they would just, love they would, you. They wouldn't be looking up the words to your act. Yeah, I think that funk is... just part of the highs and lows.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's humanity. Yeah. It's humanity, too. You're just a human, so that's what we go through daily, sometimes, multiple times throughout the day.
Yeah, I remember coming off stage on Wednesday night going, I really needed that, and because it went better than I thought. And Thursday night, I was like, I don't need any of this. I don't need any of this.
Right.
But it was also that the lesson is that, you know, you do. You got to take the bitter with the sweet, go with the bad, the ups with the downs.
Yeah.
The whites with the blacks.
That's part of life, right?
It's the Mexicans we don't need is what I'm starting to learn.
Oh, Lord God.
Kidding.
Help us.
Who's going to do our lawns?
Ouch.
I'm joking, of course.
I don't endorse any of the opinions expressed on this show, including my own.
There you go. That's the disclaimer that we should all be saying before we get on stage anymore. So what do you got coming up as far as gigs? You got anything big
planned? Cinco de Mayo, coincidentally, after you after we spoke about Hispanic folks. But Cinco de Mayo fundraiser for Westminster Presbyterian Church at a country club in Dayton. So they are having me come down and do that fundraiser. I'm looking forward to it. I've done a few presbytery gigs in the region. Presbytery is like the regional governing body of our denomination, and they hired me based on a youth gig I did, where I went and played some improv games with them and did some stand up, and it was an odd mixture. The energy's much different, and I'm not qualified to teach the games, but I can play the games with kids. And so I'm trying to discover which needs to happen first, because
it's all very organic.
Yeah. So we'll see what that crowd's like. It's a country club, and everybody there. It's a black tie event. So.
Ooh.
It should be an interesting interesting endeavor.
Now, I have been to a black guy event, but I have never been to a black tie event. I've never done a black tie comedy event, but I did do a corporate gig one time for the Semiotic Society of America, which is a
a collegiate association mm-hmm. of really intelligent mm-hmm. communications.
Nice.
Semiotics is like this rare offshoot of communications okay. based on signs and symbols and how humans make meaning of them.
All right.
And so one of my professors was, you know, offered me the gig to right. just do a little bit of comedy. And he wanted me to write semiotic jokes or whatever. And he was like, I'll help you, whatever. We never got together. So I just basically did my act and a little bit of improv. Just
wrote it out in Rebus and put it on cue cards.
Yeah. They had like, the projector. Can we get a projector here? Right. It was one of those things where it was like the worst comedy uh-huh. ever. But at the time, I think the most money I'd ever made for that amount of time. Mm-hmm. I think it was like 15 minutes and I got like $400 or
That's
something.
That's great.
Which was great. And I was like grinning from ear to ear.
Sure.
For the money and also for the fact that I didn't give up right, to them.
Right.
What I didn't know at the time was that there was like a power play going on in the room where the guy that hired me is like the president of the organization mm-hmm. and they were trying to stage a coup earlier in the day to have him like at their national yearly meeting. They were going to try to overthrow him, which isn't like normally how it's done or anything. And
nothing like that being an undercurrent during your gig.
Yeah, so the room was completely split in
That's
half.
Some Game of Thrones crap or
it
something.
It was totally some collegiate Game of Thrones. And I should have known
that the king who was on the throne was going to be overthrown later. But
you would have thought the fur capes would have gave it away, right? But I didn't see anything until the sword came out, and then I was like, no! Yeah. Yeah, dragons, man. The I didn't give up on which is something that I think is always an option. You know what I mean? Like yeah. when it's not going well, you can just walk away.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've done that more than once, unfortunately, and that's kind of been definitely put a bad taste in some people's mouths of not wanting to ask me back to their shows. That's
I did it one time,
like Ron White. His dad said, that boy's got a lot of quit in him. Sometimes you get up there and you're throwing your best and they're completely silent and you're just like, ah. But I think it gets back to where you were talking about being in our heads, that if we go in our head as though whatever the audience does to what we're saying is the only measure of how we're going to see if it's a success, then we're sunk too, I think. Because if we realize, you know, sometimes it's not just going to, we're not going to crush. That's just part of it. Doesn't mean we're a terribly worthless human being.
Well,
but
yeah,
if we make that decision on stage, which I've done a couple of times,
it's
not good.
If you're not.
Everybody feels and then they just feel sad, and then they're just like, oh.
There's something beautiful about a bomb. Mm-hmm.
Right. If it's a bomb where the person isn't devolving into
sadness.
They're worth nothing. You know, that. Yeah. But yeah, a friend that's bombing, you know, it's enjoyable.
I watched. Or maybe I didn't watch it. Jay was telling me a story about Vince. And I've had this happen before, too, where you go up before Vince Morris. And they're not laughing at you. Mm-hmm. But all you can think is, like, it's not even that it's this audience. It's me. Because Vince is going to go up and do what he
does. Destroy.
And he'll get them.
Right.
And first thing he said when he got up on stage was, like, look, I don't know what's wrong with you guys. That guy's funny. He's like, and if you don't laugh at me, it's not going to bother me at all because I know I'm funny.
Nice.
And went up and crushed.
Nice.
And, you know, just cleared the table real quick and did his thing.
He's a pro.
He is one of those kinds of guys.
I've never seen him not. Every time I've watched him, he's crushed.
I've seen him say that was work. You know what I mean? Or have kind of be like, you know. But it was also one of those things where it was like, before he even went on stage, you could tell he was kind of preoccupied.
Right.
But then he gets up there and it's like you wouldn't see any preoccupation.
Turns it on, yeah.
And I think also for him is like he's truly living. When he's on stage, which is something sometimes I've probably glimpsed life on stage, but really I'm acting.
Do you think that's some of the energy we're talking about? That
yes.
You know, because
yes.
if we are truly living and if we are truly, as cliche as it sounds, if we are fully present, you know, that I think there isn't a way to lose if you're being honest when you're fully present and you're there and you're just like in your mind before you go, my worth does not depend on how well this goes. My worth is grounded in my faith tradition. Being a beloved child of God, and in my mind, everybody's a beloved child of God. And if we have our worth grounded in that and then go on stage and we're fully present, fully awake, fully, you know, listening and giving, there are those moments. But I think that we can't fail when we're in those moments. But I've had very limited experience. Somebody might say, well, Dwight, you haven't been on at 3 a.m. in a mic in New York. When the only guy in the audience is a crackhead and he's...
And you've got his crack.
And the other comics, So, but in my limited experience, I think that really goes a long way.
I think you're right. And I think
I think that that is, well, when you're being fully present and honest, the stakes are high, but the outcome is not dependent on, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, when you're fully present and being honest with people, it's almost like you're giving, not asking to receive.
Yeah. Tell me what you mean when you say the stakes are high. I think I know what you mean, but you say when you're fully present and honest, the stakes are high. What do you mean?
When you're fully present and honest, I feel, for me, when I'm doing that, when I say that that's a phrase that I use, not with everybody, because that's not the language that most humans are operating on. But I think fully open, honest, present, for me, is, what's the word I'm looking for?
Vulnerability. So that's the risk,
being vulnerable.
You're
that's the risk.
Vulnerable. Yeah, yeah.
But
I got you. Okay.
But,
thank you.
But the upside to that is that when you're honest, there's no regret.
Right. And you don't have to try to remember what you were saying.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like, because I was just telling the truth. I don't have to come back. Oh, yeah. What was that lie?
So I had that experience. I was like, I don't block bad experiences out of my mind, but I think I'd almost block this one out, where I had a bad experience at the Columbus Funny Bone not too long ago, where I told a story that I had told once before, and it's an honest story, but once I started changing the details, it lost all the funny. And so I went back and told it this last Wednesday at the casino, honestly, and it was funny again.
Okay.
And so that was kind of the lesson in, like, well, if it's funny, honest, it'll be even funnier if I add some extra bits to it or change some of the details. But what I realized was, like you said, you don't have to remember what you said. It's like when I'm being honest, I remember extra details of what actually happened. And if I'm being, if I'm trying to embellish the story, which is what I did, I set the story on a trajectory that I couldn't recover from very early. So that's what the lesson was, like, open and honest. And the vulnerability being that this true thing that really happened to me may be not funny, you know, but like another comedian once said is, whatever it is that had you decide to even try to do comedy was the belief that you thought you were funny.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, so if you're willing to bail on that concept at any given point.
That we believe we're funny?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, then, yeah, there's no reason
there's
to
no
go
way.
Up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You don't think you're funny.
So, yeah, that's an interesting open and honest, fully present. When I did a Landmark, that's something that they talk about a lot. And I was just listening to Joe Rogan's podcast where he's interviewing the leader of Scientology, the current leader of Scientology, his dad, who's, you know, who got his son into Scientology, but his dad's not in Scientology anymore. And so it's a very interesting to listen to them talk about it, because this program that I did called Landmark Education is very similar in the language that they use and the technologies that they use at the lowest level. So like with Scientology, very much like stand-up comedy or working at Walmart or any big anything that's bigger than you, at the very base of it is this set of core values or whatever, and things that you can do that will enhance your life.
Well,
like working at Walmart,
you get
a job, you get maybe some insurance or provide for your family, whatever. Comedy, at the base level, comics are helping each other. They're telling each other about open mics. They're helping each other create a joke or whatever. But when you get to the very top of any of these endeavors, it's a very sickening kind of money-based, power-based.
Maintain the building or maintain the structure, you mean? Or
it's a lot sicker.
Feed the beast.
Yeah, because these people are at the top and they're making much bigger decisions for much larger sums of money. And so then the morals get muddied a little bit.
Yeah.
And you start building on top of that level of integrity instead of the base, you know, lowest level worker or somebody who's like, we're trying to change humanity.
Well, that's like the Christianity. That's what happened, you know?
Yeah.
Jesus came proclaiming the kingdom of God, and what he got was the church. You know?
Yeah.
It's not a very good representation all the time of what it's supposed to be, you know?
No, but it's what, it's why I feel like it doesn't really matter who
we got right now, but.
Well, it doesn't matter who the president is at the end of the day, because it's how we treat each other that makes this country great or not.
Right.
You know
what
I mean?
Sure.
And when we start.
I don't know if I agree completely, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, well, like, obviously we have this spokesperson or whatever, but it's
what makes life for the average American mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis tolerable or intolerable is how we treat each other.
Yeah.
And I think there's definitely big decisions being made mm-hmm. that make it harder on little people, easier right. on sure. wealthy people.
Right.
But if we as individuals recognize mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. and help each other, not financially, but just as humans, you know, you see somebody pulled over, you know, stuck on the side of the road or, mm-hmm. you know, and you offer them some help, or you see somebody that's hungry.
Offer them help. I was thinking you're just going to say honk and wave.
Sucks to be you.
No, you're right. I mean, there's value in human kindness and trying to spread that around for sure.
Jay said to me, and I never thought of it, but I think I felt the same way when he said it, maybe in one of our last episodes, about he thought anybody that was doing something nice for somebody
right,
else
right.
was just a Christian.
Right,
that was
yeah.
just something Christians
sure.
did.
Right. No.
And he didn't realize that being a good person is...
Yeah, well, I mean, I've asked my atheist friends, where were your ethics taught? How were you taught to do the right thing if it wasn't in church? And they just said, well, you know, just my parents. They had a way of trying to treat each other like you want to be treated. And, you know, and that was just foreign to my experience being raised in the Bible Belt and
right.
being raised in the church. It was, you know, that part of the motivation is we believe that, you know, God gave us forgiveness and kindness. And then out of gratitude for the forgiveness, then we do acts of good, you know, good acts in response to the grace. You know, it's being grateful for that. And then that grateful feeling then translates to your behavior, you know, is what it's supposed to be. So, but yeah, I heard that Jay saying that.
Yeah.
You know, but he didn't know that people could be good outside of it.
Right.
But I think he was talking about reading the Bible. He said he knew the book, and he, what else did he say? He's talking about you don't have to go to a building to, you know, to experience the ethics of it and all that. Yeah, along those lines.
Yeah, think, yeah. You know. Yeah, and I think for me, I had some of those same thoughts. I was raised, you know, going to church. And,
were you Episcopal? Remind me.
Well, my grandparents were Southern Baptist. And then, growing up,
no, I was Southern Baptist.
Okay, yeah, so you could say that.
Right. Well, I don't know.
Growing up, here in Yellow Springs, we were members of the Methodist Church. In fact, right. that was one of my first jobs.
Sure.
And it was much more of a low key than mm-hmm. the Southern Baptist. And
sure. Yeah, United Methodist is more. It's not a far cry from Presbyterian. Terms of a mainline
sure.
Denomination.
Sure. And I think we actually even attended a Presbyterian church in Dayton when I was really young. But my dad's always been the kind of, always gone to church. Mm-hmm. I think he goes to a Unity church now.
Mm.
And, or maybe I'm completely wrong about that. But something that's always been important to him, he was raised, you know, in church, uh-huh. and he was my first real Sunday school teacher.
Oh, okay.
You know.
My dad taught me, too.
Yeah. And so he made us, like, memorize the books of the Bible
right,
and stuff like
right.
that. Like, whereas before Sunday school.
How many can you remember?
Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy.
Numbers and Deuteronomy. That's first five, yeah. Five out of 66. That's not bad.
Job?
Yeah. Job's in there, yeah. Spelled Job, J-O-B.
Job, yeah. there's, like, periods where, like when I wake up in the morning or right uh-huh. before I go to bed where I feel like I can get to 20.
Nice.
You know, but uh-huh. it's and if somebody was like held a gun to my head and was like, books of the Bible, nigga, or you lose it.
I
could probably come up with two. It
I
does.
Hear that
it does.
Happens a lot out west,
it happens
especially in the
so much
cities.
More than people uh-huh. give it credit for. so I don't know what that
or
is.
Scripture jacking. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, 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 yeah. What denomination you in? break yourself, fool. We're going to pray. get on your knees.
Oh, gosh.
The lesson was, like, I coach my son in soccer.
Okay.
And mostly because I was, like, watching other people do a bad job at
right.
it, which is what my dad saw with Sunday school.
Oh, so he said I can do it right.
And, yeah.
Okay, cool.
And he did, you know, and I thought, like, even though I hated, I mean, I don't want to say I hated Sunday school. It was just that, like, you know, when I was a kid, Saturday morning was the best day of the week.
Oh, yeah.
And then Sunday morning was, like, the second best day of the week. There wasn't
right.
as many cartoons on,
right, right.
but there was still some, and you could right. still, like, sleep in, and you could still, you had the whole day ahead of you. And then, like, this, having to wake up to go to church
right.
seemed like punishment for
right.
me.
I understand.
There was never a period in my life where it didn't feel like that, except for when my dad was the Sunday school teacher, because he would, like, bring in donuts or hot chocolate or
sure,
something,
yeah.
something to kind of ease that
right.
pain
right,
of,
right.
of, and he made it fun, you know, whereas
yeah.
everybody else was kind of doing it like a daycare,
right?
Like, oh, we're gonna color in these parochial coloring books.
Right.
You know, whereas he was actually like telling the stories. Where, and my dad's a good storyteller.
That's the best part.
Yeah, the stories are amazing.
That's part of the power of scripture and the power of the faith is the stories.
It was just the first time I glimpsed it, which is funny because I thought like, well, this is going to have to transcend for my son with soccer or whatever. But, you know, and I remember thinking about it because I saw this story where Snoop Dogg was his son's football coach and his son got a full ride scholarship to play. I mean, he was like a hell of an athlete.
Yeah.
And then I guess confessed to his dad. He's like, Dad, I don't really want to play football. He's like, I was only playing because I thought that's how I would get your love. And he was like, I don't care if you play football or not. Right. And I was like, oh, my God, Snoop's a real person. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And that's what it made me realize, like, because my son plays soccer, like, he's not sure we're related. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't care about it, really.
Right,
he doesn't ever want to go do it.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, it was like my chance to be good at something.
Right.
This is where, like, when I would play soccer, that was, like, the one highlight of whatever period of time I was in. Because that was the only time I ever felt worthy or good at something.
Sure.
And
That's a powerful motivator, then. Yeah.
It is. And I think he doesn't suffer from the same crippling inadequacy that I did.
Praise God. That's
great.
That's excellent.
In a way,
now
it is.
Know he won't be a comic.
Yeah, it won't be a comic. Probably won't be great at anything. Just be average at everything. No deficits.
My son wants to be a comic. How should I help him? Withhold affection.
Yeah. Yes. That's it. A little bit of violence.
Right.
Start keeping more alcohol around the house is probably going to help. I had an epiphany the other night that, like, whenever I, because like one of my first jobs was babysitting, I'd like get these gigs from the church or just being a male babysitter in a small town was just rare because there's a couple kids that would terrorize the female babysitters that they had, and they were like, "Well, we just need a strong male figure or whatever." And I just liked to play.
Nobody else was around, so they got you. Is that?
Yeah, basically they were like, I mean, before my corruptible ages.
I'm
so that's
mean.
Where it was. That's what happened was I hung on to most of these kids because it was a good. I liked work. I was a workaholic as a kid. I had two paper routes.
I see your kids being drawn to you, and you excited and full of energy. They'd love you. So
yeah. Yeah, we played soccer. We played whatever it was. We just played, and that's why I worked for the YMCA. It was like I could play tennis with these kids, and I was like teaching them real skills. But I remember getting too old to babysit because I would be like, "This isn't worth the money I was making 4 years ago when I $2 an hour, or whatever." Like, and so like my way of exiting that relationship was to drink their alcohol. There's only two parents that ever got
passive-aggressive 2 weeks notice.
Yeah, it was, and it worked each time. It's amazing. Like, I guess he's too old to be babysitting that.
Oh man.
With a huge dose of regret and humility inside of that.
Of
you know what I mean? But we're all friends on Facebook now, and I feel like with the podcast is a way of me kind of. This is like my journal. At the end of the day, this is. Things that I can't say honestly on stage, where I can't be honest and open and fully present.
Right.
I think with the podcast, 99% of the time, I'm fully present and more honest than I am.
Well, it's more anonymous, you know. You're not looking at a crowd full of folks, you know. You're, you know, necessarily. I mean, there's people around, but it's
well, it's weird because
when
even,
we're on stage, they're there to see who's on stage. You know,
yeah,
that's what you can't run, you can't hide. There is, you know, nothing to be but. You know, there and throw your jokes and they land or not. Or
you're terrifying me by saying that out loud. I didn't realize they could see me.
Yeah,
I can't see them.
If I sound condescending at all or like I know what I'm talking about, I'm really not trying to. Yeah, am I coming across?
No,
as
not
arrogant
at all.
Or,
not at all. Not at all. Very humble. Everybody
I'm
knows
very
you're
excited.
Not that good. Everybody.
Well, that helps. that makes me be humble.
I'm kidding. That's the best part of being a comic is breaking balls. Because I had this the set I did at the Columbus Funny-O-Bone. I was like, help this kid did a great job, and I went up and talked to him.
Yeah,
and then I trashed him on stage. But not because he did a bad job, but because that's what comics do. And if you know me, you know that's what I do. Like it's not out of my color at all to go up after somebody who just had a good or bad set and start making fun of them instantly.
Right.
And it's not because if anybody really knows me, that's how you know I'm saying welcome.
Right.
Welcome to the club.
Right.
And
part of the hazing.
Yeah, it's just part of it. And
but you said his audience left before you.
Him and his family did. But see, I sent him an email the next morning. Yeah. I didn't address any of that stuff. But I was just like, hey, great. Anything I can help you with or any tips or anything that you want to do that I can help with, I'm at your disposal.
Sure.
I just, because I was inspired to see somebody that young be that fearless.
Yeah.
You know, and so, because I wish I was.
Were you there when my daughter Phoebe got on stage?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, she did all right, too.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she did a great job.
She was 9 when she went up.
What I saw with her was something I hadn't seen before, but I've seen it several times since then, which is what I call stage eyes.
Looking down.
No. It's like almost like the first second you get up there and you realize what you just did.
Oh, yeah.
And like it's kinda like that, kind of like, well, not even that. It's just like a kind of like a dilation, like, you know, the eyes open up for a second, and then it's like a grin.
Right.
Like, I guess I chose to do this. Right. You know what I mean? So I'm here. Let's go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And I saw this other girl do it when we were at the State Theater. Remember when we did that New Year's show?
Yeah, the little girl. Yeah.
The little girl that came up, and she came up on stage, and she was like, eyes just opened up, and she was just like, I think it changed her life.
I bet you
I bet you it wouldn't surprise me at all if I got an email in like 6 months, like, you know, we were at the State Theater. I don't know if you remember us, but my daughter came up on stage, and now she wants to be a ballerina or whatever it is. But it was one of those things where it was like, once you are on the stage looking down into the lights, all those people looking at you.
There's a shift,
That's like, that's got to be intoxicating, especially at that age.
Right, that's part of it, right?
When I was in elementary school, we'd do these concerts. I went to Mills Lawn, but we'd sometimes go to the high school to do our, well, you know, we're singing songs.
Right,
you
choir
know, choir. Yeah, exactly. That's what a choir. And and so, like, I had the worst
voice.
What's
that word? Yeah. Group of singing people.
Sometimes in a
together.
Church. They wear the robes.
Sounds like.
Clergy?
Spell it.
But we went, and then we're singing Rocky Top, Tennessee. You know that song, Rocky Top?
Yeah.
And this kid had a solo. And we're at Yellow Springs, you know what I mean? But this kid was, like, from Cedarville. And he had a solo. And he was the only one out of, like, 4 or 5 kids that had just a line of the song to do as a solo who sang it authentically.
Oh, okay.
It's a country song.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, and we're Rocky Top, Tennessee.
We're
articulating every.
Right.
And he gets up there, and he's got on his boots.
Yeah.
He got on his cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And he starts belting it out like it's supposed to be done.
Nice.
And the place.
Right.
And I remember thinking, I was so jealous that he got that kind of. I mean, I was like, wow, how awesome is that? Yeah. I mean, not jealous in a way like, I'm mad at him.
Right.
But like jealous in like, I wish I could experience something like that. I'm happy for him.
Oh, yeah,
you know, jealous
sure.
in like, ugh, he gets to feel that.
Right.
And he was horrified, you know, and he like stopped halfway through and stormed off the stage, his face completely red. And
that young man's name is Timothy McVeigh. I'm sorry.
So you know the story already. Okay. You could have stopped me at any time and said, hey, I already know the story.
No, but anyway, so did you keep up with him?
I don't have any other memories of this kid. I mean, it almost feels like he'd stopped going to school the next day.
Right.
And I don't think that was the case, but I just feel like it occurred to me pretty quickly that it's easy to not know. When people erupt like that, whether it's out of love or out of, but I mean, they were just blown away.
Right.
You know, and I mean, we had done rehearsals.
Right.
I'd never heard this version of it before. Right. You know, I mean, like, so it surprised everybody.
But he just owned it.
But yeah, I think it just terrified him that everybody, like, changed their response. Because before it was like, everyone's just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's my son. And he gets up there, and all of a sudden it's like, bro, you just stole the show.
Right.
And he's like, no, that's not what I wanted to do. I just wanted to blend in. Right. You know, what most kids want to do is just blend in.
But this 12-year-old, you said he did well for.
This 12-year-old at the Funny Bone, he did very well. The jokes were above his intellect for a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Tell me what you mean. I listened to that on the podcast.
Yeah, he did like a couple Donald Trump jokes.
Yeah.
And just kind of like the jokes would be like, I don't know what this means. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? But like clearly he does, you know, and like the innuendo kind of stuff, which is – you can't deliver those kinds of jokes with comedic effect if you don't understand them.
Sure.
And so
sure.
what it was to me was a like kind of a inside joke slant on being 12 in this world currently.
Right.
And I thought he, I thought he could do what it takes to get kind of far in this.
So that would be neat. What was his name? Do you remember?
No. Okay. Not off the top of my head, but his dad's business card sitting on my computer.
All right.
And he did email me back.
Okay. Well,
and he
cool.
said thanks for the advice. Clearly they did not stay for the
right.
But or at least he didn't mention if they did, but he was very, very pleasant in the email back. Mm-hmm. And my main advice for him was to keep the mic in stand, because I've tried out for America's Got Talent before. And it's such a short audition
mm-hmm.
that anything that you do,
mm-hmm.
like we were saying earlier, to start off at a deficit, mm-hmm. which would be take the mic out of the stand and now mm-hmm. not know what to do with your hands.
All right. Yeah.
Because if you keep the mic in stand, you can either hold the mic stand like this,
mm-hmm.
or you can use one hand to mm-hmm. do this or one hand to do this, but you mm-hmm. don't do that shuffle dance and you don't coil the cord.
Right.
Which are the two things that I think are the most detrimental to people mm-hmm. when they first start off doing comedy.
Yeah.
And that's the number one thing. And I see pros do it too sometimes where they'll put one loop in the mic cord or whatever, but I look at that loop now and I'm looking at the loop. And I remember one time Pauly Shore was on stage. He had a feather on his down jacket that he was wearing on stage that was sticking out, and that's all I could look at.
Oh.
So it's like, I think some con, like Vince, you wouldn't notice a feather.
No.
But if the jokes are from 1990, you start to notice
right.
the feathers.
Right, right. Well, that's why I wear the suit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know.
At least I look nice. Yeah.
I'd people, like to think.
People dress well for funerals, so it's. Yeah.
Listen, that's when you want to make the biggest impact.
Right, right, right.
Somebody's always watching at one of those things.
Nothing he said was funny, but hey, what do you think about that guy officiating at our wedding? That's why I'm really doing this.
He's a sharp dresser.
To get more wedding gigs.
That's always
The brides are always divas. They hate it when I do 5 minutes before they come down the aisle.
That would be interesting. You should start booking yourself. Like, I'll give you a discount.
Right, right. I actually did do, like, a wedding in an emergency situation. These folks had a pastor. They had a location. They had the wedding in mind. And I knew the guy and the girl. And the guy did, like, he didn't confirm. Or, like, they thought he had confirmed and he hadn't. So they called on me because they knew I was a preacher. And said, hey, would you do this? And, you know, and if you want to do any levity, you know, of course. And I'm like, all right. And so I actually wrote material that went with their vows because they'd waited to get married for like 8 years, and so like I just threw a couple of funny, they were funny to me. I was
yeah.
like, these will either hit or not, but you know, hey, it's fun and they're having fun, and at the end of the day they just wanted to be married, and it went well though. They had a really good time, and
that's interesting.
So it was fun.
On call
emergency wedding, you know.
I have a friend, a guy I worked with before, his name's Sydney Adeni. He was one of the very first guests on the podcast, and so another friend of mine in Chicago, and so he got, you know, he did like the mail order ordained minister type thing.
How many are there? I wonder how many million people do that.
I don't know, but I think the main reason people do it is so they can officiate a wedding for their friends, which is what he'd, so it was a comic.
Well, that or be a moil. But
that's
which is awesome. That's a Rachel Goldman joke. I need to give her credit. She joked about that.
That's funny.
She's hilarious. Have you heard her? She's out of Indiana.
Yeah.
And she's amazing.
Yeah,
and
we're friends on Facebook, but I don't think we've ever met
her. She's going to be in the Boston Comedy Festival and several festivals. And just if you get to catch her set, just please do.
Yeah.
Please do. She's really good.
Yeah, I've seen.
I want to try to get Chloe to see her. My daughter, oldest daughter, really digs comedy, and she's a student of it. And just I've shown her a lot of different comics, and that's one I wanted her to see live. So
is now, do you feel like she's going to? Is that something she's interested in pursuing? Is comedy?
I'm not real sure. She's backed off of it a little bit. It might have been kind of along the lines of what you were talking about with your son. Like maybe he did it for a little while because you did it or wanted him to do it.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell right now. She's kind of in her own. She's musically inclined and doing a lot of that, but she has she knows how to look at a set and say, oh, that's a callback. This is
right.
Rule of three. She can break
it.
Down. Yeah, she can
she
break down
the
things,
lingo.
And that's kind of neat.
Yeah,
she's not the one that was on stage, but she's
You know, she's the older
she's
one.
She's the older one.
She's like 17 now, right?
16.
16.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Will be 17 in November.
Is she driving already?
She hasn't gotten her permit. She doesn't want to yet. I don't know why. We've encouraged her, but I don't know about you. I got mine right when I could. I was really excited, you know.
Man, I was driving before I got my permit.
Right,
and the permit was just like going to help me drive a little more.
Legally, right.
And then I got my license. Right. And I got my license with the lowest written score you can get and still pass and the lowest driving score you can get and still pass.
Okay.
And I'm a hell of a driver.
Right.
I'm
right.
a hell of a driver.
Well, you put a lot of thousands of miles on the
hundreds
road.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands, so.
But I had to get my license. I had to redo the test one time because I let it lapse and I'd moved or whatever. So I had to take the driving test again. Once again, lowest written score, mm-hmm. lowest driving score.
Okay.
I tried to answer my phone while we were walking to my car.
Oh.
Somebody was calling me. I was like, hey, I can't talk right now. I'll call you later.
And that was.
And she was like, she stopped and she was like looking at her notebook, like just. And I was like, oh,
wow.
God, this is not. There's no joy in any of this for you. Mm. I was like, okay. But it was one of those situations where I realized never let your license lapse again.
Right.
Always get it early.
Right.
That's not worth it.
That's true.
What do you got going on the rest of this weekend, Bubby?
Well, got to preach on Sunday. Got Holy Humor Sunday coming up this coming Sunday. So doing silly jokes and things like that. Just different people going to tell jokes during worship. And the liturgy is structured around jokes and humor in general. And they're even the sermon's geared about talking about like the party after the resurrection. And so it's a fun thing. A pastor out of Sterling, Illinois, Christina Berry, she wrote the service, I think, in 2012, and we're using the script from that. And it's a silly day, kind of a fun day, and then you know, enjoy it.
That's awesome.
I had some comics come do that a couple years ago. Wendy Ferguson and Dan Dean, and who else came? Jack Legg, several others, you know, came and just participated in the Holy Humor Sunday, and that was kind of that was fun. You know, different
That's
experience.
Great.
You know,
that is great. Yeah, we've done a couple church things together, mm-hmm. For other people's churches.
Been a long time.
Has been a long time.
Well,
and I always felt.
Like you said, I'm no good, so you just.
Well, look who's saying it. Look who's saying it, though, Dwight.
That's good. I'm going to be driving home later. Oh, man. I can't believe this.
I was thinking to myself, like, I was just trying to come up with some questions for you or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was like, how can I push this so close to the edge that on the drive home, Dwight says, hey, man, you can't air that.
right. That's what I was wondering, that number of F-bombs in the like in the first 30 seconds, you and Jay, and I'm like, I wonder if I'm going to have to, like, say that. Yeah.
Well, that's our drinking game.
Right,
so
okay.
So that takes the pressure off of us to not have to say it.
Okay.
But on the other side of it was, until one of the people that listens to the podcast, which is something I was getting ready to say, is like, I'm still not comfortable with, like, when you were saying you were listening to the podcast, mm-hmm. I was like, really? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like I don't expect people to listen, because, like, I don't know how to say this without being overly consumed with myself, but, like,
it's impossible.
My homepage for my computer opens up onto the analytics for the podcast.
Right.
So the very first thing I see every time I open the internet is
how many
people have listened since the last time I opened it. So
how many downloads you get?
Each episode is going to get 50 downloads in the first week, and then 50 over the course of over the rest of that month.
Okay.
So I'd say each episode at least 100.
Right.
And sometimes when we do like a specialty, like we did Judge Michael, that one did like 220 in the first day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, you know, historically our most listened to. And it's still people, I don't know if they're going back to it or.
Right.
But when we get a new listener, they tend to go back and listen to 10 or 20 episodes.
Right. I haven't listened regularly. I've downloaded a couple of them and listened, but
I think that's.
But I did listen
typical.
To the one that most recently, you know, just so I could kind of get a feel for what I'm doing here and not be completely in the dark.
That's what I do when somebody asks me to be on their podcast. Is I go listen to see what the flavor is.
Right.
I don't want to be up in there. Talking about my drug use and alcohol abuse.
Well, that was the last episode. I was just like,
and that was not what we planned on doing. That was not where we planned on going.
Talk about recovery in this episode.
Yeah. Well, I think eventually, you know, if we keep going, you're going to see one of us go to rehab or something of that effect.
I don't know why I thought Jay had gone into rehab or gone into maybe a couple of weeks. Maybe I don't know. Are he and Renda still together?
No, not currently.
I was thinking that they, like, maybe I'd heard that was the case, is he was going to try to stop, and when they were separate, I don't know. It's been a while though, so I don't know.
Well, Jay,
I don't want to run somebody else's life. Excuse me, that's talking out of school.
Yeah, telling stories out of school. No,
they hope split for the up. Best for whatever they choose.
I don't even know when it was exactly now, but
it's none of my business or the listener's business either. Shouldn't
well, now we got to clean it up because you brought up the topic.
Right.
So
I'll
make a go back 30 seconds and clean that
all
up.
Right.
So tell me about your kids.
Right.
No, let's end on something. A mutual memory.
All right.
Any of them, anything major come to mind for you? We've got.
Like best memory ever of.
Not have to be best.
The best memory I have of you is getting off stage on. They were having this Super Bowl comedy show at the Funny Bone in Dayton. and everybody was kind of mailing it in, not taking it very seriously, but I took it like my Star Search audition.
remember that.
And, like, I wrote a funny, tight 5-minute set. I'd gone to this writing class, a comedy class.
It was like a mic drop set.
Right. And I just came up and just, and the contrast was stark because, again, no one was horrible, but they weren't really taking it. And I mean, I really was like, I want to do the best I've ever done in my life, you know.
Yeah.
And I did really, really well. And you gave me a hug and said, good job, you know, after that was a real high moment for me in terms of, you know, and you and I had maybe spoke, I don't know how, like before that you had sat down with me or something and we had written some and so it was just kind of a fun, fun memory. And
I remember
some lofty aspiration stuff, you know, with Karen and Jaffe and doing improv stuff and all those photos you guys did.
Yeah. The slave ship elevator.
That
was fun.
Fun to see all that. And,
people always said when I first started, like, cherish these times. These are the ones that you're going to go back and remember, you know, the time. And it really is true. It's not like I'm not still in that sort of, but.
But now you're doing the grind, right?
Yeah, now, I mean, like, well, you know, when you're sitting in a casino by yourself at 11 right. o'clock and right. you don't know anybody right. and you think, like, man, why was this so much fun when I first started? And now I'm getting paid and
right.
I'm right. lonely.
Right.
But I think that's. We create our own reality, and I would like to create a reality where I'm able to take my friends with me on things like that. So that's why it's important to me to always, like, offer road work when I can
right.
to take somebody that I know I can
sure.
enjoy
well,
the
then,
time.
And that would be probably the worst memory I have of this. You invited me to do a show over, I don't even know where, near Columbus, and I was on stage, and I don't know if I was supposed to do 20 minutes or what I was supposed to do, but somebody behind the bar had a flashlight light on it.
Yeah.
They held it up high above their head and they're already a little elevated.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the light. I was
yeah.
like, wait, I haven't been up here that long. And they held it up and I like pointed at it and did a couple more jokes. And I'm like, that can't be the light. And then they held it up again to take another photo. And I was like, oh my God. And so I thought that was the light. And I was like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. I just, you know,
I remember that.
And
I remember
now. That was like I'd done like 12 or.
Well, that was about 12 minutes. You were supposed to do 20. I think you did 12.
Yeah. It wasn't as much. I didn't do my time. And that's one of the things I remember hearing more than once is, you know, just do your time. I've even heard a comic saying that a comic came off stage and they're like, no, no, no. Go back. Do
yeah.
your time. You know?
Yeah.
So that was like. That was really bad, and then you haven't asked me back.
Well, I never.
I and then the booker hasn't ever talked to me after that either.
The booker never talked to me again.
Oh,
so
sorry, man.
No, I don't think
I take at least part responsibility.
No,
in that
I don't think it was you. Yeah, to be honest, the only critique that I got after that show was from my set, and I wasn't really receptive to the critiques.
All right.
I was like, hey, you know. You know my act, and you know me. And so if you can't defend me to the audience, just don't book me.
Oh, so they just didn't like what you had to say, huh?
I think they thought that I was a rape apologist.
Oh, wow.
And my thought to...
Oh, because you were doing some Cosby stuff back then or what? Or in general? I don't even remember other than
I don't even
remember.
I think I had the open with the Cosby joke or whatever, and then I think I had a callback to that joke later in my set or whatever. Oh. But and then I also do another joke where the word rape is mentioned, but it's not like a rape apology joke or anything. Like, it's definitely like a rape is bad type of thing.
Right.
But I think just having... the context of rape come up 3 times in a 45 minute set. Actually, I think I did 55 minutes.
Right. You probably had to.
which was like, well, if I have to do extra time,
terrible,
it's going to be all
rape
material.
Right.
And it was one of those things, like, I think now it wouldn't. Well, because of that, let's put it this way, I'm much more cognizant of those types of things.
Well, that's good.
But at that same token, I was thinking of the booker, like, you should have been able to defend yourself and me. To whoever it was that complained and never even mentioned it to me.
Right,
but the
right,
fact that you feel like you have to mention that to me, even though you know who I am and how I am.
Right.
I mean, hindsight being 2020, I'm glad that I did get the information because it did affect how I now perform.
Well, and that's definitely a hotbed of controversy and having 2 daughters. I don't want to ever really make jokes about it either in my life. And it's just, it's wrong. And so I don't really.
It is.
There isn't any funny rape joke to me. And I even remember reading other, you know, if you're a really upper echelon comic, you can get away with it. And I don't, you know, I'm not going to laugh at it, but I can't, obviously. I mean, it's not in my wheelhouse. I'm not going to.
I think there's
be
a difference
a pastor,
between.
To me, none of them are funny.
I think that's the same thing
it's about power, domination, and control. And that's just not, I hate that in any context. And that's part of what I'm a Christian for.
Sure.
You stand against that, you know.
Sure. So. And I think that using the word doesn't necessarily mean that you're a proponent. And I think we see the same thing with the N-word.
Right.
There's a, like Joe Rogan says it on his podcast a lot, but he's not saying, oh, you mean that? You know, he's talking about like, what is it? That it's the power of the word and the user that's saying it. Same with Louis C.K. Like people are like, oh, white guys can't say nigger. It's like, no, you can, but you just can't go out there saying it without explaining why you're talking about it.
Right,
you know what
I
mean? And if you're not willing to do the legwork that it takes, then don't even bother.
Legwork meaning be a success for 20 years and
multimillionaire. No. Just being able to set up the context to which people feel
I'm an all or nothing in that, too. I think if you're white, you can't say it regardless, ever.
Well,
I mean, obviously, you're mixed, so I guess I don't know what the rule is or if there is a rule, but I would say that since you have some African American in you, that probably that is it like not frowned upon for you to use that word or
my ownership of it is one that I've never understood what it means. I've never experienced being biracial. I've experienced being black.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's I don't really.
And I haven't, never will, so I never get to use that word.
But when it comes to like the word never. Or can't, it's simply not true.
Yeah.
People do use it. People can use it. And
yeah.
people will continue to use
they
it.
Do.
And I think that context is everything.
Oh, that's true.
And I think that giving a word too much power is a problem.
Right.
And for me, you know, because you know my famous closing joke where I use that word.
Right. Yeah, and the knock-knock joke, right?
And I never make anybody wrong for saying it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I will say, you know, silence was the right answer, but this is progress.
Right.
You know, because if I knock on your door, I know you let me in. Mm-hmm. And when they don't say it, you know, I kind of make fun of them for, you don't want to answer the door. You know, so it's like, it is a joke I'm not proud of because it's a trigger word that I'm getting a big laugh on. But I am proud of that joke because I feel like the younger generation, like the kids coming up today, don't have the hatred and the vitriol attached to that word that my generation does. Mm-hmm. And it's even more so for my dad's generation.
But in part because the road has been paved for this youngest generation, not to say they don't experience a lot of BS. Just saying that in part because of the history that's gone before, and then so therefore maybe learn maybe a little more respect for it. I don't know. I have no authority or no experience in this at all, even less than anything else I've said. Just my opinion. So
my point, I guess, that I'm trying to say is that it does us no good as a society or a people to say this historic word or whatever, because I think the evolution of that word has been one that it was used against us, then we took it from being used against us so that we could have the power of it. I'm not saying that we hand it back out to lose any power that we have from it, but what I am saying is that the unintended consequence of us owning it and rappers using it and then selling millions of CDs to white kids, you're taking the power out of the word. And to me, that's a good thing.
Right.
I'm not saying that you're ever going to take – that's not the same thing as rape, right, where it's never going to be okay.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, or okay to joke about that. But I think the idea that a slur or a slang word has so much power that somebody could lose their life just for uttering it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in 2017 to me.
I don't know.
Now, I mean, I think that, like, if somebody's looking to get their ass beat and so they start throwing the word around, then indulge them.
Right,
you know,
I'm
a pacifist. So to me, it's not ever going – I have to respect you for you to upset me.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's true, yeah.
So it's like –
no one can hurt us if we don't let them, right?
I mean, I don't want to – I think it was Socrates that said
I drank what?
That's my favorite quote ever.
That's from Real Genius, right?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, it's from Real Genius, Val Kilmer. Yeah.
I thought it was
it might be somebody else too, but it's
I thought Robin Williams said it in Good Will Hunting.
He might have, but I know it was in Real Genius too.
Who says it in Real Genius?
I think it's Val Kilmer.
All right, I'm gonna look that up when we're done. Fact check, Twitter. Yeah, I don't remember what we were talking about after that. But I was going to say, I think it was Socrates that said, sticks and stones may break my bones, but the Socrates. N-word can never hurt me. Pretty sure. He was mixed. Right, a lot of people don't know that he was also mixed. And I think also, like...
And he never was very successful in a rap career either, though.
No, he never got that. His B-sides, mostly, mixtapes. Yeah. He could never really get it going. Well, I mean, you know, back then, you couldn't Chance the Rapper. You had to get signed,
right,
you know.
And right.
And Socrates was just wasn't deals out there.
Living out of that cave and all. So.
I think that your approach to it, to the word, mm-hmm. and never having such an absolutist approach to it is the safest. Mm. Because you don't need to say it. Nobody needs to say
it. There's never a context in which that's going to be appropriate coming out of my mouth.
Yeah. Unless somebody was like, unless you had a young child say to you, Dad, what's this word? And why am I not allowed to say it? And then you could explain why it's such a bad word or whatever. But you can do that without saying it.
That's right. Yeah. You're going to do it without saying it.
Yeah.
Can I tell you why, like, my experience of my dad stopping using that word?
Okay.
I grew up, my dad and mom owned a produce store in West Virginia, and we would drive down to the farmer's market in Columbia, South Carolina. This is in the 70s. I was born in 71, so about 76. I was about 5 or 6 years old. We went down to the Columbia farmer's market, and my dad would not like use that word every day or anything, but he would use it on occasion and was racist for sure. And that was a bad example. And he and I never talked about it, and I didn't make use of it. To my knowledge, I don't know if there were any black folks in our school at all. But anyway, not that that would have been a good time to use it. I'm just saying, I don't recall really having any thought about the word at all, other than that I'd heard him say it and hadn't quite learned yet why it's not all right. But we went to this farmer's market and we're loading up the truck, and there's a loading jack thing that you push pallets full of produce with.
Sure.
And there was a guy named John, and he was real sweet, and he always let me ride on the it was a motorized loading jack, and he's just real kind to me. Happened to be a black fella, and somebody that owned the produce store came up to him and said, "Watch this," to my dad, and told him to dance and threw money at his feet. And after that, and called him the word, and I was dumbfounded. My dad was so ashamed and completely filled with shame and horrified, as he should have been. And so I asked him about, like, we talked after that, and he was like,
"How old were you?"
Probably 5 or 6, maybe 6. And he said, "Yeah, you don't ever need to use that word. And what he did there, that's wrong. You don't ever treat another human being like that. And that, you know, don't use that word. That's it's demeaning. And I've used it, and I've been wrong to use it. And I can't use that word in front of you anymore." And so yeah. I can't say that I got in a fight with a guy in junior high and used the slur. I was angry and when I was 14, impulse control, stuff like that. But yeah, it wasn't a good thing to say. But in terms of setting the tone and learning about that word and the power of it and the inappropriateness of using it, that was a pretty powerful lesson to see that. That was in South Carolina, a very racist thing, and pretty early education on, you know, how not to treat people. But
I had a situation where I was using a Jewish slur. I didn't realize how offensive it was until a Jewish person pointed it out to me. And I don't even think it was a slur. I think I just said Jew. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or whatever. But the kid was Jewish. And it wasn't like my thing. It was like something all of my friends were doing. And it was like the first time I said it, it was like the wrong way to say it or something.
Right.
And I got called on it. And this one kid went straight into like... Mm-hmm. Okay, well, fuck you, nigger, fuck you, nigger. Right. And I'm like, I can kick your ass.
Right, right.
He can't kick my ass. Right. And I said it one time. You're definitely making this worse.
Right, right.
You know?
Right.
And but it was like a wake-up call, and I realized, like, at that point. But kids say horrible things all the time.
Right.
You know? And I think it's up to us to not... to let the experience happen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because just like what you said with your fight or whatever, it's like you were able to mature through the experience of having it happen. And I think that when we say this word has so much power, you're never even allowed to say it, it doesn't have as much experiential value. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, this is just a banned word. It's like then suddenly people just start. It's like Stanhope says, it's because you're not supposed to say it, it makes people want to say it. It's like when you
say, well, you can't say retarded mm-hmm. anymore. You know, mm-hmm. now you have to say, it's like, right. how many people say special needs mm-hmm. instead of retarded now
right.
in the same category mm-hmm. as retarded? It's mm-hmm. like, no matter what you substitute that word in, we're going to mm-hmm. co-opt it,
right.
you know, for right. making fun of people. And it's not,
right.
That's just the slippery slope of right. banning words.
Changing the language doesn't necessarily change the behavior or the feeling behind it.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I got to ask you this.
It's a start.
Did he dance?
I think he probably did a little bit. Yeah, I can't remember, to be honest with you. I just remember my dad looking down in shame and having me walk away, but I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah, that's not really the lesson, but it was interesting. It would be interesting to me if he danced or picked up the money.
I think I just noticed that. No, I don't think he picked up the money. I think we all just kind of were shocked. And then the guy, the owner of the store, was laughing. I remember that. But I don't remember. I just remember the palpable feeling. I remember feeling shame. Like my dad, it seemed like my dad felt ashamed, and then I felt ashamed because I knew the guy was making fun of him, even if I didn't know exactly what was going on.
Right.
So, weird memory.
It is. I was listening to Bert Kreischer's podcast, and he had Godfrey on, mm-hmm. and Godfrey's a very articulate, passionate, mm-hmm. you know, black man. Mm-hmm. And he was having this discussion about having dignity mm-hmm. and the difference between like blackface and other types of mm-hmm. racial appropriation, not even racial, but cultural appropriation. Because mm-hmm. Bert was saying something about a sketch he was doing where they had somebody act like they were gay, and he called it gay face. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's like gay face.
Right.
But Godfrey corrected him very articulately about the difference being that the sketch that they were playing wasn't being played to make gay people look silly, mm-hmm. you know what mm-hmm. I mean? It was just an actor taking on the part of a gay person. He wasn't making mm-hmm. the gay person, you know, look bad mm-hmm. or stereotypical or anything like that. It was just a part. And whereas, you know, blackface was like something white people would do mm-hmm. and then they would embellish right. and make it very right. silly kind of a thing. But I started thinking about dignity in terms of what it meant to be a black man for my dad and mm-hmm. versus what it means for me. Generationally, mm-hmm. you know, and I carry a certain amount of my dad's experiences with me because my dad couldn't go to movie theaters when he was a kid because they were segregated mm-hmm. in the South. Mm-hmm. And his brothers and sisters would make fun of him and say that if he wore a hat, he was so light skinned, if he wore mm-hmm. a hat, he could go. Mm-hmm. And so when people are like, oh, everything's better now, everything's, you know, racism's over, you know, it's post-racial society. It's like, my dad's still alive. And so people that were in power or have, right. you know, the kids of those people that thought that was okay, mm. they're still alive too. And it's, things are getting better, but progress isn't a destination.
No. Well, and if you want to take it back to talk, if you wanted to talk about marijuana.
Boy, I was waiting for you to bring it up, Pastor, because I've got some confessions to Mike.
Well, but from what I've heard, either radio or otherwise, is that the way that industry is falling out is in terms of the financial wealth that people are being shut out based on socioeconomics and based on, you know, which in terms of social injustice in our society, a lot of times, our society is set up financially against a lot of black folks in general from the time they're born. And so that industry as in the, like in Denver and I guess in Washington State and then all the, you know, so you're saying racism, we're not post-racial.
Yeah.
No, we're definitely not.
Yeah.
We're now industrializing it. We've made it corporate. You know, it's been corporate, but I mean, it continues to be the rich get richer. And, you know, a lot of times the biggest positions of power held by a lot of white men in general. So,
I mean, Kennedy's dad was a bootlegger.
So.
You know, and then he became president. So it's like, you know, prohibition is what made him wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And then prohibition's over and he's not mm-hmm. a criminal anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, to me, that's all we're really dealing with now. But you're right. It is a matter of like, yes, they did legalize or decriminalize or whatever, but the mechanics behind
another
that.
Another way of screwing people who don't have money out of money.
Yes. Like, yeah. Well, the mechanics behind that are.
Let's send somebody to jail for 20 years for a dime bag, but if you have 100 grand, you can invest in selling it for a living.
Let's make sure the right people are in charge of this.
Controlling that, you know. So, anyway.
Well, that's a great high note to end the conversation on there, Dwight. I appreciate your ringing endorsement. No, it's been a good one. And this is the kind of like when I have an interview, mm-hmm. you know, this is the kind of stuff me and Jay don't
get into. So I think that's why Totally Unrelated is the best title for the podcast, because right. you never know
it's
what you're going to get.
It's not a theme of any kind in particular. Yeah.
No, and it's also, like I said, it's a running journal of our lives, right. you know, culturally right. as comics. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot
I'm
of.
I'm hoping for the least downloaded episode. That's what.
Don't push it
gonna,
then. Yeah, just
open up your.
I'm gonna tag you in it so that your flock
right.
can
open up the open up the page. Man, 5 downloads. That's.
You know, I'm just gonna pull this episode.
All,
I don't
and
want.
They're all mine from different IPs.
I yeah, 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 yeah.
Went
yeah.
to the church and download it.
Yeah, yeah, because I can tell if somebody's downloading from the same IP address. I can see it all. And like I said, I am a little bit manic about it, but not because I'm looking for bigger numbers, but just because
right.
I like to see.
Right.
Like, if I go in and, like, 2 days in a row there's been 0 downloads, I'm like, I need a reason to feel bad about myself.
Right, I get that. We seek ways of beating ourselves up.
Oh, man, don't we? But Dwight, it's been an honor to have you on the cast, man, and hopefully we'll get you back here.
My pleasure. Maybe, glad to do it.
Maybe we get you sit down with Jay one time.
That'd be fun. I love Jay. He's hilarious.
He's the best, man.
Someone else's dream, he says it's all right. The beat.
listening. Download more episodes from the Podbean app. Also available at iTunes and Stitcher or at totallyunrelated.com.